Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm a real estate person at heart, and it's all about location. And I said, look at this location on the sea. Look at this beautiful piece of property, what it could be for so many people. It'll be so, so great. People that are living so poorly are going to be living so well.
As President Trump lays out his vision for a post-war Gaza, what some might call Trump Gaza, we'll speak with TropSite News reporter Sharif Abdelkaddous about his new investigation, leaked documents. Planned community in Rafah would force Palestinians into Israeli panopticon. Then to Minneapolis, we'll talk to the lawyer for Nakima Levy Armstrong, who is still in jail after she was arrested after peacefully protesting in a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as a pastor.
David Easterwood is a pastor here. He is also the director of the field office for ICE in St. Paul. So someone who claims to worship God, teaching people in this church about God, is out there overseeing ICE agents.
We'll also speak with a union member who's part of one of the many unions joining today's Day of Truth and Freedom, an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents into Minnesota. And today marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Paul Robeson, the great actor, singer, athlete, scholar, blacklisted and hounded by the government for his political beliefs. We'll look at a new book, Kings and Pawns, on how Jackie Robinson, the Brooklyn Dodgers star who integrated the all-white major baseball leagues, was pressured to testify against Robeson before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee.
I've been asked to express my views on Paul Robeson's statement in Paris.
One man is now a legend. The other was erased from history.
We'll speak with acclaimed sports journalist Howard Bryant, author of Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, hundreds of businesses are expected to close today as part of a one-day economic blackout to protest the ongoing ICE immigration crackdown. Organizers of today's strike include faith leaders and unions. They're calling for people to not work, go to school, or shop. Businesses closing include the famed Walker Arts Center. On Thursday, the prominent Twin Cities civil rights activist and attorney, Nakima Levy Armstrong, and two others were arrested on federal charges for their role in peacefully protesting inside a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as a pastor. The three face charges under the FACE Act. That's the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a law written to protect abortion clinics. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced Levy Armstrong's arrest. Then the White House posted an AI-generated image to make it appear Levy Armstrong was crying after her arrest. Her skin was made to look darker. The Justice Department also attempted to bring charges against the journalist and former CNN anchor Don Lemon, who covered the church protest. But a federal magistrate judge rejected the request. We'll speak to Nakima Levy Armstrong's lawyer and get an update on today's economic blackout after headlines. Outrage is growing in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, after ICE agents detained a 5-year-old boy named Liam Ramos and his father, who's an asylum seeker. Photos from the scene show a masked agent standing next to Liam, who's wearing his backpack and a blue winter hat with bunny ears. He just returned from preschool. The father and son were then quickly sent to a detention jail in Texas. On Thursday, Vice President J.D. Vance visited Minneapolis and defended ICE for targeting the boy's father and detaining the preschooler.
So the story is that ICE detained a five-year-old. Well, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to let a five-year-old child freeze to death?
Local officials in Columbia Heights condemned the detention of five-year-old Liam Ramos. Rachel James serves on the Columbia Heights City Council. She described efforts by neighbors to protect the little boy.
I heard one neighbor say, I live in this house. I'm part of this family. I can take him. Let him come to me. I heard another neighbor on the other side say, I have the forms. His mom signed the forms. Let me have him. I know him. I know him. I kept saying, stop, wait. He can go with us. He can go with the teachers. And then they took him over to the car, and he was just standing there. And then they quickly put him in the back seat and drove away.
On Thursday, the lawyer for the Ramos family, Mark Prokosh, said Liam and his dad had come to the U.S. in 2024 from Ecuador seeking asylum.
Liam and his dad did enter the United States at a port of entry to seek asylum through the CBP One app at the Brownsville border crossing. So they did everything right when they came in. They used the app, they made an appointment, they came to the border and presented themselves to Customs and Border Patrol. They've shared all of their information with the government, and they were following the process. They were just trying to secure safety and persecution for their family from their home country. But ICE didn't care about the fact that they had those pending claims and then just arrested them.
On Capitol Hill, seven Democratic lawmakers joined Republicans to pass a $1.2 trillion government funding package that includes $64 billion more for the Department of Homeland Security and $10 billion more for ICE. The Democrats voting for the measure were Henry Cuellar and Vicente Gonzalez, both of Texas, Jared Golden of Maine, Marie Gluzin, Kemp Perez of Washington, Don Davis of North Carolina, and Laura Gillen and Tom Suozzi, both of New York. In news from Gaza, Israeli tank shelling killed four Palestinians Thursday. The killings came as President Trump was launching his so-called Board of Peace in Davos, Switzerland. At the ceremony, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, outlined his vision for turning Gaza into a glitzy seaside resort filled with futuristic high-rise buildings.
In the Middle East, they build cities like this in, 2-3 million people. They build this in 3 years. And so stuff like this is very doable if we make it happen.
Kushner said the first phase of the project would be rebuilding the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which was leveled by Israel. The Rafah border crossing with Egypt is expected to reopen next week. Many Palestinians fear Israel and the U.S. will move to forcibly displace them from Gaza. On Thursday, Israeli President Isaac Herzog met in Davos with the leader of Somalia's breakaway Somaliland region. Israel recently became the first nation in the world to recognize Somaliland as an independent nation. They've been reports. Israel wants to expel Palestinians en masse from Gaza to Somaliland. This all comes as Palestinians in Gaza struggle to survive with little food or shelter. This is Mohammed Al-Kudra in Khan Yunis speaking about Trump's plan for Gaza.
No matter how much he says, it's all in vain. Why? Because we as citizens aren't seeing any real change on the ground. The suffering remains the same. Rain, there are no tents, no shelters, as you can see. The destruction, wood, we don't have that. President Trump announced that the second phase had begun, but we haven't seen anything. People in Al-Mawasi are living in tents, displaced. People in the east can't reach their homes. You can hear the shooting, the shelling, day and night, martyrs.
Russian, Ukrainian, and U.S. negotiators have begun meeting in Abu Dhabi for the first trilateral talk since Russia invaded Ukraine almost 4 years ago. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said he hopes the talks are a step towards ending the war. On Thursday, Zelensky met with President Trump in Davos, with Russian President Vladimir Putin, met with Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner in Moscow. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Trump administration's been plotting ways to topple the Cuban government in the wake of the U.S. abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The Journal reports the U.S. is, quote, searching for Cuban government insiders who can help cut a deal, unquote, to push out the current leadership. On Thursday, The Guardian reported the U.S. used a similar model in Venezuela. Four sources told the paper that Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, and her powerful brother, Jorge, had pledged to cooperate with the Trump administration if Maduro was removed from power. Rodriguez is now serving as Venezuela's interim leader. The United States officially left the World Health Organization Thursday. Public health experts fear the U.S. decision will hinder global public health initiatives. Dr. Thomas Frieden, the former head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, called the withdrawal a grave error. He said, quote, health threats do not respect borders and weakening global cooperation makes Americans less safe, unquote. The Trump administration's ordered a review of almost all federal funding going to more than a dozen Democratic-led states. The move comes just days after President Trump threatened to suspend federal funding for sanctuary cities and states at the end of the month. States that could be impacted include California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington, as well as Washington, D.C. Former special counsel Jack Smith testified before Congress Thursday and defended his decision to indict Donald Trump for seeking to overturn the 2020 election and removing classified documents from the White House.
Stand by my decisions as special counsel, including the decision to bring charges against President Trump. Our investigation developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in criminal activity. If asked whether to prosecute a former president based on the same facts today, I would do so regardless of whether that president was a Democrat or a Republican. No one should be above the law in this country, and the law required that he be held to account. So that is what I did.
During the hearing, Washington Congressmember Pramila Jayapal questioned Jack Smith about the importance of accountability.
How would you describe the toll on our democracy if we do not hold a president accountable for attempting to steal an election?
My belief is that if we do not hold the most powerful people in our society to the same standards of the rule of law, it can be catastrophic.
A major Trump billionaire ally is now the partial owner of the social media platform TikTok. A group of investors, including Larry Ellison's company Oracle, agreed to a $14 billion deal to give them control of the U.S. version of the platform being spun off from ByteDance, a Chinese-owned company. In 2024, Congress banned TikTok, claiming national security concerns over its ties to China. But Trump had allowed the platform to keep operating as a deal was worked out. Ellison is also the largest shareholder of Paramount, the parent company of CBS. And in the Philippines, a radio journalist has been sentenced to between 12 and 18 years in prison in a case widely condemned by press freedom groups. Frenchie May Cumpio has been jailed since February 2020, when she and four others were arrested for allegedly having ties to the Communist Party of the Philippines. She was convicted of terror financing. UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Opinion Irene Khan has criticized Cumpio's prosecution, saying the charges were filed, quote, in retaliation for her work as a journalist, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at the Trump administration's contested plans for a post-war Gaza. As President Trump formally inaugurated his so-called Board of Peace at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Thursday, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, presented his vision of turning Gaza into an upscale, futuristic seaside resort with gleaming skyscrapers and entirely new cities, an ambitious proposal that would require an investment of at least $25 billion. Kushner outlined the so-called Gaza Master Plan as he presented slides, one of which showed a map of the besieged territory divided into different zones. Kushner said the first phase of the project would be to rebuild the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which was leveled by Israeli attacks. The Rafah border crossing with Egypt is expected to reopen next week. Families in Gaza fear Israel and the U.S. will move to forcibly displace them to another country. This is Jared Kushner laying out his plan.
We've developed ways to redevelop Gaza. Gaza, as President Trump's been saying, has amazing potential, and this is for the people of Gaza. We've developed it into zones. In the beginning, we were toying with the idea of saying, let's build a free zone, and then we have a Hamas zone. And then we said, you know what, let's just plan for catastrophic success.
President Trump presented his concluding remarks on the plan Thursday, saying, quote, we're going to be very successful in Gaza.
Real estate person at heart, and it's all about location. And I said, look at this location on the sea. Look at this beautiful piece of property, what it could be for so many people. It'll be so, so great. People that are living so poorly are going to be living so well.
This all comes as Palestinians in Gaza struggle to survive with little food or shelter due to Israel's relentless blockade of humanitarian aid. This is Mohammed Al-Khodra and Khan Yunis responding to Trump's plan for Gaza.
No matter how much he says, it's all in vain. Why? Because we as citizens aren't seeing any real change on the ground. The suffering remains the same. Rain, there are no tents, no shelters, as you can see. The destruction, wood, we don't have that. President Trump announced that the second phase had begun, but we haven't seen anything. People in Al-Mawasi are living in tents, displaced. People in the east can't reach their homes. You can hear the shooting, the shelling, day and night, martyrs.
For more, we're joined by Sharif Abdelkaddous, the award-winning journalist and Middle East North Africa editor at Dropsite News. His new piece is headlined, Leaked Documents, Planned Community in Rafah Would Force Palestinians into Israeli Panopticon. He's joining us from Los Angeles. Sharif, thanks so much for being with us on Democracy Now! Start off by responding to what happened yesterday in Davos, Switzerland. President Trump, surrounded by many autocrats of the world, signing on to a charter agreement for the so-called Board of Peace, which Trump will lead even beyond his presidency, lead indefinitely. He personally has veto power and is in charge of the money, apparently $1 billion a seat for those who will be part of this Board of Peace. If you can respond to that and then lay out what you've learned from leaked documents.
Right. Well, it's $1 billion to have a permanent seat. People who signed up get 3 years. But, you know, if we look at the charter of the Board of Peace, there's no mention of Palestine. There's no mention of Palestinians. There's no mention of Gaza. There's no mention of the right of return. There's no mention of the right to self-determination. What it does say is that, you know, Trump is chairman for life and it gives him these, you know, king-like powers. Where he can only be replaced if he resigns, or if he is deemed incapacitated but it needs to be a unanimous vote that is, you know, it's kind of unattainable. He can appoint new member states, he can veto any decision. And so you have this Board of Peace, you have what's called the Founding Executive Board underneath that, that has people like Jared Kushner, Marco Rubio, and others on it. And then you have something under that called the Gaza Executive Board, which is made up of Palestinian technocrats that are supposed to implement these policies. So this is almost a farcical manifestation of colonialism in the 21st century. It's kind of like a parody of a colonial body. You know, if you had proposed this a few years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room, except that now it's actually real. And at the event yesterday, you played a clip of it, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, you know, delivered this presentation of what he called the master plan for Gaza's redevelopment and reconstruction. And yeah, you saw these kind of, you know, these renderings of high coastal towers and mixed zones and so forth. It looked like an AI fantasy. And let me just say, one of the slides in the presentation included Arabic script incorrectly written in reverse, so from left to right. Arabic script is written from right to left, and with the letters disconnected. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to take these people seriously. I mean, they're buffoonish. But the problem is that they control the largest military and economy in the world. But what we actually, you know, when he talks about residential zones and the future of Gaza, we actually now have a glimpse of what is actually being planned. And it is extremely frightening. It's very Orwellian. So first, what we have to understand is that Gaza has effectively been cut in half. So after October 10th, the Israeli military withdrew to what's called now the Yellow Line, and they occupy and control over 50% of the Gaza Strip. And analysis of satellite imagery by Forensic Architecture that we published at Dropsite News shows how Israel is physically altering the geography of the land in that part of Gaza east of the Yellow Line that it does control. So what they're doing is they're constructing a lot of military infrastructure. There's been 13 military outposts built just since the ceasefire. So now there's something like 48 or 50 military outposts in this area. They've also built roads that are being connected to bases and settlements outside of Gaza in Israel. And what they're doing is essentially establishing facts on the ground. This is what Israel always does. Facts on the ground that will eventually become permanent. And actually, just yesterday, we found out that Israel is digging a trench that is many meters deep along the Yellow Line in Gaza, basically to prevent Palestinians from crossing from one side to the other, to the side that Israel controls. So Gaza is literally being cut in half with a moat. So this is the new reality. And what they're doing, in addition to this construction of military outposts and roads, is also systematic destruction of Palestinian property, of buildings and of infrastructure. And what we found, what Forensic Architecture found through the satellite analysis, is that there's 1 square kilometer between 2 military corridors in southern Gaza, in Rafah, where Israel is engaged in a pattern that's not visible anywhere else. What they're doing is they are raising the land, they're compacting the ground, and they're clearing the rubble. And they're doing this in a way that suggests this is the site of the first so-called residential zone or planned community where it's going to be built. And we know that they're starting in Rafah. And so what will this so-called planned community look like? Last week, the Civil Military Coordination Center, the CMCC, which is a U.S.-led body, held a presentation for this so-called planned community. Now, the CMCC was established by CENTCOM a week after the ceasefire went into effect. It's led by a U.S. Army Lieutenant General, you know, and it's supposed to oversee the and monitor the implementation of the ceasefire. It's located in this, you know, big warehouse in southern Israel. And what last week they held this big presentation for this planned community that's supposed to house up to 25,000 Palestinians in Rafah. And we obtained leaked documents of this presentation. And they kind of very meticulously outline what this area is going to look like. It goes through, you know, the municipality, the economy, health, education, law and order. And after actually reviewing a transcript of these materials, which we sent to Jonathan Whittall, who is a former senior UN official, you know, in Palestine from 2002 to 2005. I'm sorry, 2022 to 25. He said that these new communities built on the rubble of people's homes are not only governance labs to test ultimate control and subjugation, but they're also the reincarnation of refugee camps. So we can go through, some of what these documents show. So let me just briefly say. So first, it provides a set of criteria for deciding which Palestinians will be, quote, invited to live there. And this includes undergoing security checks to prevent the entry of what they called Hamas elements. It doesn't specify who's going to be doing these security checks, But historically, in Gaza, the movement of Palestinians, for example, in and out of Gaza, has always been controlled by COGAT, which is the branch of the Israeli military that oversees the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So to enter the so-called housing zone or planned community, Palestinians will have to pass through a security checkpoint, and everyone entering will be registered with biometric documentation to enable them to move around, to enable them to access services. And that registry will be based on Palestinian ID numbers in coordination with COGAT. So, you know, the Israeli military already has an incredible amount of monitoring and surveillance of Palestinians in Gaza, but this gives them an, you know, yet another layer of monitoring through biometric documentation. For the economy, for example, it brings all economic transactions under increased surveillance. So Gaza, you know, historically has a cash-based economy. Now, the Palestinians living in this zone will be used something called electronic shekel wallets to do transactions. It also says that residents should be able to import products into Gaza, but those products will be subject to security checks at the crossings. It makes no mention of the fact that Israel controls all the crossings. And as we know, for the last 20 years, they've enforced a siege on Gaza where they prevented many goods from coming in.
Go ahead, Ron. Yeah, Sharif, if I can just interrupt you, I'm just trying to get a sense of the issue of the so-called Palestinian technocrats that are supposedly implementing this. Could you talk about that aspect of it and the relationship of the so-called technocrats to the resistance forces within Gaza?
Well, I mean, these are different people, among them Ali Shaath, who is the head of it, who's a former member of the Palestinian Authority. You know, he's the one who announced at the event through video link yesterday at Davos that the Rafah border crossing will be open in both ways next week. They're selected to, you know, implement these policies on the ground. Originally, the idea was that different Palestinian factions would appoint this kind of committee through a democratic process, but that didn't happen. They were just selected by the U.S., by Israel, and so forth. The reaction of Palestinian factions to their appointment has been actually interesting. They haven't outright condemned them for joining this. Hamas put out a statement that seemed semi-supportive of them. And I think, you know, they've been put in a position where any Palestinian kind of input to try and get some aid into Gaza, to try and ease the suffering of Palestinians, to try and you know, help engineer what the future of Gaza will be, was kind of welcome. But the problem is that they are, you know, multi-layers down in this hierarchical structure, this colonial mandate structure that is overseeing Gaza. You have the Board of Peace, you have Trump as emperor of it, you have this founding executive committee, and then, you know, they're under that. They have absolutely no sovereignty, no control, and no real say over the decisions of the lives of Palestinians in Gaza.
And you've written that this first proposed residential zone is sometimes referred to as the Emirati compound. Could you talk about the role of the UAE in all of this?
Yeah, it's referred to in the presentation as the Emirati compound. It's unclear, you know, why that name was chosen. There is the Emirati Field Hospital in Rafah that is not far from this site where this first zone is being built. Now, you know, under the education part of this presentation and this is perhaps the kind of like the most Orwellian part of it, it says that they should create schooling and a curriculum that, quote, will not be Hamas-based, but will follow culture of peace principles, for example, modeled after the UAE, end quote. Now, that phrase, a culture of peace, is mentioned in the normalization agreement between the United Arab Emirates and Israel that was signed in 2020 as part of the Abraham Accords. Now, since then, the UAE has normalized relations with Israel more than any other Arab country. They have very robust trade, tourism, defense deals, surveillance, like tech deals. And it seems that this idea of, you know, the education idea for this housing zone is aimed at promoting an Emirati-inspired re-education program that will promote normalization with Israel. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about this presentation is that it also says that, you know, the land on which it's being built, they need to examine the private rights of Palestinian property holders so they can see about mechanisms for compensation to these, you know, whoever's land it once was. You know, they have the nerve to mention private property rights of Palestinians in Gaza, where nearly the entire population has been displaced, mostly multiple times. Nearly the, you know, every building has been damaged or destroyed outright. And, you know, there's a general.